Go ahead and open up to John chapter 11, the very end of John 11, picking up in verse 45 this morning. We'll look at the end of John 11 and the first part of John 12. Jesus' most impressive miracle, perhaps, in the Gospel of John up until this point, we just saw in chapter 11 last week. And to remind you, if it's been a week or if you weren't here last week, to catch you up, in John chapter 11, we get this great miracle where Jesus raises this man Lazarus from the dead after he's been dead for 4 days. So it's really clear that he's dead. There's no doubt about that. He's dead, and they roll away the stone and Jesus raises him from the dead. It's a profound and significant miracle. And what this did in the aftermath of it that we'll see this week is it revealed the ruling motives of people's hearts. What did they most want? There's this miracle that puts the power of Christ on display, that affirms his very identity as the Messiah, and yet we'll see that some people were more concerned about their own power and authority or more concerned about money than they were about knowing the truth about Jesus. The chief priests and the Pharisees, these religious leaders, their primary concern, as we'll see here, was preserving this very real, even if somewhat meager, power that they had delegated to them by the Romans. And they were concerned they were going to lose that. Judas, we'll see in this passage as well, wanted money. And he was even willing to steal to get it if he could. For both of these groups, they missed Jesus, though. They had the very Son of God in their midst who had just done this great miracle, but they missed it in a sense. They didn't recognize it. They didn't see it for what it was because of these ruling motives where they were most concerned about their own power or about money. When we think of power, we think of influence, whether it's formal or informal. We think of authority. We might think of political power. When we think of money, in both of these, power and money can be useful tools but terrible masters. They're useful tools that can be used for good, but when they rule us, then great harm can come. We can use a position of influence for good and for Christ, whether that is at work, it's in politics, or it's in the local church, or we can crave power in itself and use it for ourselves. And same thing for money. Money can be used for great things, to provide for our own needs. It can be used for generosity. Even for enjoyment. And yet it can become a master that we serve and we crave for itself and the status that we think it brings. And so in this passage, in these narratives, we see really a warning about those things and the way those can be ruling motives of our hearts. And we see a better alternative where we focus on worship and devotion of Christ. Let's go ahead and read this now. So John 11, I'll pick up in verse 45, which is the very end of what we saw last week, but just to catch us up there, and we'll go from John 11, 45 to then John 12, verse 11. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? This man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish." Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim. And there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking for Jesus and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was to report it so that they might seize him. Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Jesus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him supper there, and Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people?" Now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Therefore Jesus said to her, "Let her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." A large crowd of the Jews then learned that he was there, and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. But the chief priests planned to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Jesus. Okay, so we see these three scenes. This first scene with this council where they're concerned with power. And then we see this middle scene where there's a transition where Jesus goes back and forth from Jerusalem. And then we see this third scene in this home where we see Judas's love of money put on display. So let's walk through these. This first scene, we see this warning that some want power more than they want Jesus. Some want power more than they want Jesus. We see right at the end, in verses 45 and 46, the end of that narrative with Lazarus, that many believed. They saw this resurrection. They saw what Jesus had done. It was undeniable. And so many, they believed. They believed in Jesus. You're the Messiah. And yet others, it says, went and told these religious leaders what had happened. And it's implied that they told from malicious intent because of how things unfolded. And so the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council. Your translation might say council, or it might say Sanhedrin, which is the literal word that's used. And Sanhedrin could be used in a technical sense of this council that was formal and official and was about had about 70 men who were made up of the chief priests and the religious leaders and the Pharisees. And they were given a delegated authority by the Romans to oversee Jewish religious affairs. It could also be used informally, the term council of just an informal gathering. It's likely, because of who's there, that it's meant in this formal sense. These 70 or so who gather with this delegated authority because they've got a problem on their hands and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. And so they ask, what are we doing? And the way that's worded, it could be like an exclamation, like, what are we doing? Or a sincere question, like, what are we going to do about this? And notice the way they describe it. They don't deny what Jesus is doing or accuse him to be a fake. They say, verse 47, "This man is performing many signs. This last one was so bold, so clear, so public," they couldn't really deny it or say that it was fake. They even call it a sign. But they say, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. And then their concern is displayed. The Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. They were given this delegated authority by the Romans to oversee Jewish religious affairs and some freedom in that. And they say, if all these people start following him, then the Romans are going to get upset. They're going to see him as a usurper, and they're going to come and take away our place and our nation. Notice that their concern is not for the people, and it's not for the truth. They're not saying, you know, if they're the religious leaders and the people are following what they think is a false Messiah, shouldn't that be their main concern? Like, these people are believing something untrue. This guy is a liar. They're going to be led astray. They should be concerned for the people if they really think that's the case. Or shouldn't they be concerned for the truth? Like, wanting to know, like, is this really the Messiah? He's doing these signs. And yet, that's not what they're concerned about here. What's described is this concern of we're going to lose our place, meaning our position of power here, and our nation, our autonomy under the Romans. The Romans, the regions that they ruled over, in the Middle East and extending throughout their reign, they did give a fair measure of local freedom to a degree. But if there was any sense that there was going to be a rebellion or a revolution, then they would squash that violently and quickly. So we call this period of time, we call it the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, where there was a fair amount of stability, but it was a stability enforced with the sword. And so their concern was, if the Romans see this guy being lifted up as a king, people believing in him, then they're going to swoop in with the sword. In a sense, in AD 70, that is what happened, not for those exact reasons, but the Romans came in and destroyed the temple. And then in AD 132, another kind of round of that. But again, here, their concern is not, is this really the Messiah? Or if they concluded no, a concern for the people, no, it's power. We're going to lose our position. So Caiaphas speaks up here. Look there in verse 49. Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, the high priest was a position appointed by the Romans to lead this group. And they usually served less than 2 years because it was a pretty difficult spot to be in. You're between the Romans and the Jewish people. And so it was usually a pretty short-lived tenure. Caiaphas ends up serving almost 20 years in this role, which is sort of an indication of probably his political savviness. And so he speaks up. And first thing he says is, well, he insults everybody in the room. He says, you know nothing at all. Which is a little bit of an insight into the dynamics of this room, of this Sanhedrin. I was reading about it this week, and apparently it was a pretty rowdy place, often with insults going back and forth like that. It's a little bit like, has anybody seen videos of the British Parliament in action? I'm sure you watch it all the time, right? When I was a student at ISU, one of my favorite classes was a comparative politics class, and we, as part of that, talked about different political systems, and he had us watch a video of the British Parliament in action. And I don't know what I expected. I think of British people as just like really polite and reserved. And maybe they are in most cases, but not in Parliament. They're lined up kind of against each other, and they're just yelling back and forth, often insulting, and then cheering when somebody lands a pretty good insult. Everybody else is cheering or booing. It's a rowdy place. And that's kind of what the Sanhedrin was like, apparently. It was a pretty rowdy place. And Caiaphas, as the leader of this, he throws out this kind of insult first. You know nothing at all. And then he says something that is so significant. It's loaded with meaning that he doesn't even get. He means it in a unrighteous, negative way, and yet God in his providence is speaking truth through Caiaphas, but not in the way that Caiaphas intends. So look at it. If you still have your Bibles open, look at verse 50. He says, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you, it's good, it's beneficial for you, that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish. And then John comments on this. He says, now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. It's this just like peak of irony where Caiaphas means this in an unjust, wicked way that tries to preserve their own power. They're saying, it's better for us that this guy die, implying that we kill him, than that we lose our nation. Let's sacrifice this guy for the nation. It's expedient that that happens. And he even uses sacrificial language, the word for, that one man die for the people. It's the same Greek word, huper, that is used of sacrifice, when something is sacrificed in place of something else. But John says that God is sovereignly working, even through Caiaphas's words, to communicate a much greater truth. That even though Caiaphas's intention was evil, and that he was acting unjustly, God was communicating through it a greater truth, that Jesus would die for the people, not in the way that Caiaphas intends, but die for sin in the place of sinners. John MacArthur puts it pretty succinctly. He says, God sovereignly turned his wicked, blasphemous words into truth. Caiaphas understood Jesus' death as substitutionary, but basically saying it's better for us to kill this guy than that the Romans come in and take away our power. But God means it in a greater sense, that he would die for the people. And not even just the Jewish people, not just the nation, he says, but all these that he's going to bring to himself. So if we ask the question, why did Jesus die? We see multiple answers just in this passage. Why did Jesus die? On the one hand, we could say he died because these power-hungry religious leaders were willing to sacrifice him to keep their own position. That's historically accurate. Theologically, we could say he died because he died for us. He died for our sin. He died in our place. And God willingly laid upon him our sins. He died for us in that way. Both of those are true. Well, one is looking at it historically. How did it get to that point? But then theologically, what is God accomplishing? John communicates that as well. But it says from this day on, they plan to kill him. They've tried several times to kill him, but now they're planning it. It's very intentional. It's methodical. So once again, Jesus, he leaves Jerusalem to go someplace a little bit safer. We see him going back and forth from Jerusalem to this region, it says, is in the city of Ephraim, which is about 12 miles away. So he leaves Jerusalem, but he only has to go really less than a full day's walk, 12 miles away, to get some security. Because the epicenter, or really the conflict, was there. But he goes outside the city, it's not stirred up in that same way. So he goes just a little ways away, but it says the Passover is coming near, and he'll go back to Jerusalem for the Passover. This will now be the third Passover in the Gospel of John, and that's what helps us to mark time in this book. In these 3 years of public ministry, we're now nearing the end, this third Passover. The first one was in John chapter 2, right after Jesus turns the water to wine. We get that in John chapter 2. The second Passover was in John chapter 6. So if you're following along in John 6, there's once again another Passover. And now this is the third and final one here in coming up in John, in the chapters to come. What that means is we are nearing the end. We're nearing this final Passover, which is that same week as the week he goes to the cross. And so if you're looking at the Gospel of John, and if you know there's 21 chapters, you might be looking at this thinking, we're near the end of chapter 11, but we're almost to the cross in terms of chronology. It's because John gives much more time to that last week of Jesus' life. That if you put the pieces together, he really gives 11 chapters to all that's happened so far. The description theologically of who Jesus is, his early life, which is, John doesn't give much time to, these 3 years of ministry and teaching and miracles, 11 chapters to that, but now 10 chapters to the final week and the resurrection. It tells us that is the focus here. In fact, some people describe the Gospel of John as a long, like as a passion narrative with a long introduction. And so these 11 chapters are, in a sense, an introduction to this last week. And now John will slow down and we'll look at this last week with great detail. So we go from back and forth to Jerusalem to now to Jerusalem again in chapter 12. And this meal, and what's exposed at this meal, is that some, in this case Judas, but it can reveal our hearts as well, want money more than they want Jesus. In John chapter 12, you see in verse 1, it says, Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany where Lazarus was. So now 6 days before the Passover. We don't know how long that intermediate period that we just read was, where he left Jerusalem, went to Ephraim. It at most was a couple months. It could have been much shorter. It might have been only a couple weeks or even days. It doesn't really tell us. And it's a short enough distance, he could go back and forth pretty easily. But at most, a couple months. And now he comes back, and it tells us it's 6 days before the Passover. This meal probably would have been Saturday night after the sun went down. So it's the Sabbath day on Saturday, but then after the sun goes down, by the Jewish reckoning, it's the next day. So it's likely after the sun goes down, it's the celebration meal that he's gathered with. and the Passover is approaching, 6 days away. At this point, then, we can compare the other Gospels, and we can get a pretty clear timeline of what's happening this last week. And so I want to put it on the screen here. And if you have the sermon notes, if you open it up, this is written in there as well. And it's just to help orient you to where we're at in the life of Jesus and what is still to come. And it'll help you to know what to expect for the rest of John's Gospel. So I'm going to give you a timeline of what we call Holy Week, this last week before the cross. On Saturday is what we're reading about right now, this meal at Bethany outside of Jerusalem. He's only 2 miles outside of Jerusalem. He's right on the very edge of the city now. So it's practically Jerusalem, just right outside. And it's this meal that we're going to talk about. The next day, Sunday, is the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. J.O. just preached on that the Sunday before Easter. We can see that in other gospel accounts. In John's gospel, it happens in John 12. So we'll cover that again here in just a coming week. But it's this triumphal entry where he goes into Jerusalem and they cry out, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." That's the very next day from this meal that we're about to talk about. On Monday, as we compare the various gospels, the four gospels, that's when he cleared the temple, which is the second time he does that in his ministry. One was early on and then one was later on. He'll do that on Monday. On Tuesday, there's temple controversies where there's controversy over who he is and what he's doing, and a long teaching time that we call the Olivet Discourse that is more looking towards end times things. On Wednesday of that week, the Sanhedrin, that same council, plots to kill Jesus. In John 11, they stated their intention to do that. In the middle of that week, they're coming up with a plan. They're plotting how they're going to carry that out. That Thursday, it's the Last Supper with his disciples. And then there's what we call the Upper Room Discourse, this teaching time with his disciples. And notice that's going to be John 13 through 17. So those five chapters, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, all take place that night, that Thursday night, where Jesus, he teaches on what it is to love one another. He talks about the Holy Spirit. He talks about what it is to be united to him. He prays and they listen in. And so we still have 10 chapters to go in John, but it'll really slow down to give some attention, showing how important this last week is. So, Upper Room Discourse that Thursday night. That Friday, he's arrested. He's on trial. There's the crucifixion. Saturday, he's in the tomb. And that Sunday is the resurrection appearances. We're getting there. It's 6 days away. The cross is 6 days away. The clock is ticking. To use the language of John, the hour is at hand. He has consistently said, "My hour has not yet come," but now it's coming. So that hangs over this. But now, there's a party. And there's a meal. And he's at this home with this family that he loves. Remember the last time that he was there, there were a bunch of people gathered in the home. Could be this same home. It's likely this is a different home. It's probably the home of a guy named Simon the leper. But there were people in a home, but they were mourners, and they were preparing to eat a funeral meal the last time he was with them. This is a very different meal now. It's a celebration. It's the same people, but they're eating with Jesus, and rather than this death of Lazarus hanging over them, Lazarus, the one raised from the dead, is there. He's at this meal. If we compare it to the other passages, Mark and Matthew talk about this also, we see that it is likely in this home of Simon the leper, likely no longer a leper because Jesus had healed him. The disciples are there also, and there's this family. Martha is there. And what is Martha doing? Martha is serving. And if you know this family, that was a contentious point in another scene where Martha was serving and Mary was listening to the teaching, and Martha says, "Why isn't she helping me?" And Jesus corrects that. Now Martha's serving and not complaining, or at least the complaint is not recorded in the passage. If it's in her heart, it's not recorded. But she's serving. Lazarus is there. It says Lazarus is reclining at the table. You might hear that term and wonder, what does that mean that he's reclining? That's the term that would be used, because unlike how we would have a meal where we'd sit in chairs up against the table would be low. They would lay on their side, often on their left elbow, and they'd reach over with their right hand and grab their food. So they were reclining. They were like laying down at the table. Try it at Thanksgiving. You know, see how that goes. Worked good for them. It was cultural practice. Worked good for them. And so he was reclining. What would you have asked Lazarus if you were next to him there? I mean, I would just be full of questions. And what were those days in the tomb like? How do you feel now? Did he heal everything wrong with you? You know, like if his back hurt from his teenage years, is his back now healed too? Like, is the scar from when he fell when he was a kid, is that scar gone? I mean, did he heal everything, or did he just bring you back to the condition you were in right before you died? Like, we don't have all these questions. There's a cottage industry of books of people who've supposedly died and gone to heaven and come back. And I'm skeptical of those accounts, because often they describe things that are actually not consistent with the Bible. But here we have somebody who did die and is back. I would have been full of questions. And yet the emphasis here is not on Lazarus. It is on Jesus, as it is appropriate. So Mary is also there. Remember, Martha, Lazarus, and Mary are siblings, we know from John 11. And Mary's there, and she offers a costly sacrifice. In each of the three descriptions of Mary, each of the three passages that she's in, we see a passionate devotion. We see her in Luke 10 at his feet listening to him teach. We see in John 11, she's at his feet in tears, saying, "Where were you? If you would have been here, my brother would not have died." And now we see him, you see her at his feet, anointing his feet with oil. So I wonder, what is happening here? She takes this jar of costly perfumed oil. It says about a pound. It's about the size, picture like the size of a pop can. That's about probably the content of this. And it was in an alabaster jar, meaning a stone jar that had been carved out. So even the jar itself would have been valuable, and she probably had to break it open to access this and pour it out. It was very expensive, it tells us here. It was worth 300 denarii, which is 300 days' wages. So in modern terms, $25,000 or more. But at a time when people used their day's wages to eat that day. And so to have 300 days' wages to spend on perfume indicates likely great wealth for this family, or somehow it was a family heirloom that they had acquired. And she takes it, and she pours it on his feet. It had a fragrant scent, which is why it was so expensive. It's called nard. It's from a plant called spikenard, which, if you can picture, they're in the Middle East now. They're in Israel. This came from the mountains of the Himalayan mountains in India. And it was gathered from the roots of this plant there, turned into a pure perfume, and in the trade system, brought all the way there. And so it gives a little bit of a window into the trade that was happening at that time in the ancient world. And she pours it out on his feet. Culturally, anointing a guest with oil was a sign of hospitality. Biblically, anointing was a way of recognizing a king or a prophet. In the Old Testament, they were anointed. In fact, the word Messiah, that's in the word Christ in the New Testament, literally means anointed. And so it could be that she's recognizing this by this act. Jesus also talks about how it's anticipating his death. That was an act that would have done as well for one who had died. And so she pours it out. But Judas objects. And he does so with a veneer of piety, a covering of virtuous motives. Look what he says, verse 5. "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people?" It sounds virtuous, but John tells us that it was because he used to steal from the money that was given, and he wanted that money for himself, is what's implied. Now, notice that's with the benefit of hindsight. He did not know that at the time. They did not know that Judas was intending to betray Jesus. In fact, later at that Last Supper that we kind of looked ahead at, Jesus will say, one of you is going to betray me. And they're not all, it's Judas. I know it. Like, look at his beady eyes, right? It's got to be him. They did not, no, they're asking, is it me? They didn't know. He just appeared like one of them. But with the benefit of hindsight and with the inspiration of the Spirit as John writes this, he's saying he's already intending to kill Jesus and he was a thief. But they didn't know that. But he's planning to keep this for himself. Judas was cloaking selfish motives with virtuous goals. He's saying that he wants to help the poor, but really he wants to help himself. It was a ruling motive of his heart to accumulate these things for himself, even if he needed to sin to get it. And so keep in mind, this is after 3 years of ministry with Jesus, 3 years of side-by-side with him, of hearing him teach, of seeing his sinless life, of seeing miracle after miracle, including this most recent one of raising Lazarus from the dead. And still, what he wants is money. And it was a ruling desire for him. The New Testament warns about how money can function that way, that it's not a bad thing in itself, and it can be used for good. And yet, there can be a temptation that comes along with seeking it that we see displayed with Judas. One of the clearest passages on this is in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Starting in verse 6, it says, "But godliness is actually a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment." So the great gain there is not financial gain. It's gain in terms of just life and maturity. It's a means of great gain when it's accompanied by contentment. "For we have brought nothing into this world, so we cannot take anything out of it either." When we come into this world, we've had lots of babies born recently, they're all broke, every one of them, right? Their parents might have some resources, but they're broke. And all of us will leave this world in the same way. "Brought nothing into the world, cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content." We so often crave more, but if we can develop this, that if we have food and covering, we'll be content. Guard ourselves from some temptation, because as he goes on, he says, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction." It's not wealth in itself. The Bible does not just condemn wealth or wealthy people in themselves, but what it says is those who want to get rich, that are aiming for that, that are ruled by that, they can get caught up and harmful desires which plunge them into ruin and destruction. Which, of course, isn't that what we're seeing with Judas? He's betraying the very Son of God, and he's cloaking it, at least what he's saying about this woman, with a desire to help the poor, but really he's just wanting to help himself. He goes on here. "For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil." Not money itself. Doesn't say money is a root of all sorts of evil, but the love of it. "And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." So we say it's a good tool, money, whether you have a lot or a little. It's a good tool. It can be used for good, but it's a terrible master. If we're ruled by it, the desire for money, and we chase after it, and we compromise to get it, we can justify all sorts of things when that becomes a ruling desire of our heart. We see that on display with Judas. Jesus, in contrast, he supports her action. He says, "Let her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial." He's honoring and recognizing this sacrificial gift. It could be that she didn't quite pour it all out, and he's saying, some she's keeping for my burial, which they did not realize would be less than a week ahead. And then he says this interesting statement, verse 8, "For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." Some have taken that in different ways to minimize care for the poor. As if the poor is always going to be there, so why should we care for them? Others have almost swung to the other side and said, he's not here now physically, but the poor are, so that should be our sole focus, is caring for the poor. And I think on either of those extremes, we can miss it. He's not dismissing care for the poor. In fact, the Bible from beginning to end encourages us, teaches us to have compassion on those with need and look for ways to meet them. And so that is a good thing. But what he is pointing out is that her unique act of sacrifice, of worship, of recognizing who he is and honoring him was good and appropriate, and his death was coming where he would not be there much longer. And so thinking about kind of application for us there, now we will always have opportunities to care for the poor, and we should, and we should take them. And yet, if that becomes our sole focus, especially maybe you can think of like as a church, churches can get so that their whole mission then is oriented around meeting material needs. That's good to meet those needs, but they miss that we're here to worship and to get the gospel out. And we have a mission that way. And so there's been some pendulum swings back and forth at times where churches are only concerned about the poor and they miss the greater mission to get the gospel out and to be a worshiping people that care about truth. There can be a swing the other way too, that we neglect care for the poor and only focus on truth. D.A. Carson has a great quote in his commentary on John that hits on both of these. It says, if self-righteous piety sometimes snuffs out genuine compassion, so just to pause right there, he says there can be a type of piety that so says, you know, we're just focused on the gospel, we're focused on truth, we're focused on worship, that it actually ends up snuffing out real compassion, and suddenly we don't have compassion for people who need it. He's acknowledging that can be a temptation, but he goes on, he says, it must also be admitted with shame that social activism, even that which meets real needs, sometimes masks a spirit that knows nothing of worship and adoration. He's saying that, yes, there's a danger in kind of pious language that neglects the poor, but there's also a danger in just making your whole mission about that, social activism, and that masking that we don't have a heart for the Lord and for worship and for the gospel. The key is to hold on to both, to hold on to a true, firm commitment to Christ, that fuels care for the poor. We gather, we worship, we study, we get the gospel out, and maybe you volunteer at Valley Mission or something like that to help distribute food to those who need it. That's good. That's good. The danger is when that becomes our sole mission and we neglect worship. Okay, as we wrap this up, what the leaders feared is coming true even by the end of this section. The risen Lazarus is there. Jesus is there. The crowds are gathering, not just to see Jesus, but Lazarus, this guy that he raised. And at the end of verse 11, it says, on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Jesus. Which, tying that in to what the Sanhedrin had discussed, you could see how the tension is rising. Many are believing in him. They've got to do something, and that'll come. Let's apply this. I'm just going to give you one point. Let's ask this question for each of us of ourselves. What is my relationship to power and money? You might think your answer to that is my relationship is I have none of either, right? You think that might be true of others, yes, but I have none of either. And I would encourage you, though, to really consider if that's true, that even if you have less, just to look at the money side of it, less relative wealth compared to others in America, if you expand your view out, it's likely that you're in the top 5 or 10% of the world when it comes to wealth, just by virtue of being and living in America. And if you look through history, we're probably in the top 1% of the world history in terms of just sheer wealth. So I would question whether it's actually true, but it's also true that we can be ruled by something even when we don't have it. We're ruled by the desire for it. And we're discontent without it. And so we can still be ruled by these desires even when, from our perspective, we might not have those things. But especially if we're in some sort of position, either of power or wealth, we just need to recognize the particular temptations there. Am I using these things to serve Christ and to honor Christ and to bless people, or am I just ruled by a desire for them? And I'm willing to sin to get it or to keep it. So on the side of power, you think of influence, whether it's formal or informal. It's a position or it's just relational influence you have. Or you might think of authority, or you might even think of political power. Am I using that for the glory of God, or am I consumed with getting or keeping that in such a way that I sin to get it, or I compromise? It's easy to see in like the political realm, where you think of like a politician who enters into office with certain promises, but then changes those over time to keep his position or her position and to stay in office. And so they're just constantly changing merely to keep power. That's easy to blame politicians for that, right? Because they're not here. It's harder to look at our own hearts and say, is there a hint of that in myself, where I am using or misusing a certain position for myself rather than the glory of God? So in the local church, that might look like, especially those that serve as elders or deacons, those who lead a particular ministry, those who lead a Bible study, those with just informal influence as well. Am I more concerned with keeping that and exercising some power, or with honoring Christ and serving people? And when we get ruled by that desire, we can justify all sorts of things. It might be the case at work. You might have a particular position of authority there. Are you using that to bless customers and your coworkers and employees, or is it a self-centered aim? Is it done for the glory of God or for yourself? And then for money, for all of us, to just consider, is it a tool or is it a master? Is it something that's neither good nor bad in itself, and I can use it for good, which might include, you know, giving, might include providing for your family, even enjoying, you know, a vacation and things. It's not like those things are wrong, but am I using it as a tool for that, or am I just ruled by a desire to get more, and I'm discontent until I get more, but it's pretty vague what more actually is, and am I willing to sin to get more? That's when this warning would be applicable to us.